since chapter 14. So we are continuing our sermon series in Genesis. We have come to chapter 14 now. This is message number 15 in the series. And the title of this message is Servant of the Most High. And we'll be looking at Genesis chapter 14. And we're going to start with verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. Well, chapter 13 records the conflict between Lot and Abraham, between their herdsmen because of the pasturing of their extensive herds, and that conflict follows right after Abraham's brief sojourn into Egypt because of the famine that had come about in Canaan land. And so these accounts establish a thematic pattern concerning the testing of faith, and that's going to continue as you go on forward into the book of Genesis. Now, God had promised to make Abraham great, to make a great nation of him, to bless others through him. And then, given the choice, Lot chose to separate from Abraham and to head toward Sodom. Well, in chapter 13, we saw that in the giving of this choice, that Abraham saw no need to try to grasp the land or to wrestle the land from Lot, and just gave him a free choice. And of course, Lot's choice in chapter 13 is filled with foreshadowings of just how bad that choice was, and he is obviously there contrasted with the actions of Abraham. Well, then we progress into chapter number 14, and chapter 14 gives us a big battle scene. This chapter is full of people and places and nations and cities and all of these kind of things, but when you read the chapter, actual description of the battles are just very minimal. Very little is actually said about them. We don't get any sort of detail of the hand-to-hand combat and the arrows and the swords and the spears and the shields and all of these things that were involved. As we come into chapter 14, we see this word for king that shows up there beginning in verse number 1. This is the first time in Genesis that this word has appeared, but it's used 27 times in this chapter. And so we get these names of kings and territories and cities and kingdoms and nations and coalitions between nations and so on. And so it has the effect, as you read this chapter, of Abraham being seen as quite small. In other words, you read this chapter about all these great kings and nations and all these peoples and places and these armies, all these things going on, and Abraham is just a foreigner, a wanderer in already settled lands. Now, he has been promised the land, but there are hostile enemies who demonstrate willingness to fight for the land. They're not just going to hand it over. Well, Lot continues also in this narrative, and his separation from Abraham has left him vulnerable, and he ends up being taken. Then, of course, this chapter ends with the rescue of Lot and the aftermath there. So as we look at this chapter, I'm going to do so in two main parts, in verses 1 to 16, where we see the account of Abraham doing battle with the kings, and in verses 17 to 24, where we see the account of Abraham meeting the priest king. So we're going to start here with verses 1 to 16, this first part where Abraham is doing battle with the kings. And let's start with the first six verses. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the vale of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. And in the 14th year came Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth, Karnaim, and the Zuzims in Ham, and the Emims in Shava Kiriathaim, and the Horites in the Mount Seir unto Elparon, which is by the wilderness. So the chapter opens up mentioning these four kings of the east of Canaan, and these were obviously very dominant kings, very important kings, in control of a lot of territory. And we see these different references like Shinar and Elisar and Elam and Goim. So we can trace these most likely to the areas that are referred to. So Shinar is obviously referring to Babylonia. Elisar is most likely connected to Assyria. Elam is in what we would consider in modern-day Iran. Goim, or nations, is a Tidal king of nations. That's the term Goim, which is the ploem of, or the plural, rather, of Goy. It's a rather general term, but the name Tidal itself has been associated with the Hittites, which would place these nations in modern-day eastern Turkey in the Anatolia region. Now, these four kings invaded what we know as the Jordan Valley in the region of the Dead Sea, and that's the Salt Sea that you see referred to there in the Valley of Siddim. This would be the Dead Sea in the Jordan Valley, and brought these five kings that were in that region, brought them under tribute. Now, obviously, under tribute, they would conquer the nation, but they wouldn't totally captivate and carry away the nation. They would leave there a sort of a vassal ruler, as it was referred to, and they would have to pay taxes and all of that to the conquering nation. And so that is what had taken place, as we read about in the opening verses. And then we find that those five kings of the Salt Sea region had actually rebelled against these eastern kings. And so in response, the eastern kings invaded from the north and headed toward the south. And so that's what we're reading, a north-to-south movement, as we look at these peoples and places that are mentioned going down through here. And we can also identify most likely most of these places as well. So Ashtaroth, Karnaim, this was a region east of the Sea of Galilee. The reference to Ham would be in northern Gilead. Shava, Kirathaim was on the border of Moab. Mount Seir was of the place of the Edomites. Elparon to the Gulf of Aqaba. And then after that, as you read through as it unfolds, they moved to the northwest to Kadesh Barnea, the area of the Amalekites and of the Amorites. Now, we also have mention of some peoples here that we don't know a lot about these peoples, the Rephaim, the Zuzim, and the Emims. We don't really know a lot about them, but they are mentioned or otherwise referred to as some of the giants of the land of Canaan that comes about later in the account of Joshua, and we learn about them in Deuteronomy and during the conquest. And so these were obviously some of the giant peoples that were in the land of Canaan at that time. We just don't really know a lot about them otherwise. But this is how this chapter opens, with this these eastern kings moving in into this region because these five kings in the region of the Salt Sea had rebelled against them. So then we come to verses 7 to 12. And they returned and came to Enmashpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites, and dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And there went out of the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar. And they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elisar, four kings with five. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there, and they that remained fled to the mountain. And they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went away. And they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So the five kings of the Valley of Siddim, this is in that, again, in that region of the Dead Sea, these five kings in this region, they join together and they go out to oppose these four kings from the east. Now, this reference to the slime pits most likely refers to tar pits, as I understand, which are common in the region due to the bitumen that is in that region. And the kings retreated there, and Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities, were taken. And it's described as all of the goods and the food. And from what we read on later, we realize that all the people were carried away captive from these places as well. But then you notice that you come down to verse number 12, and they also took Lot. Now, Lot reenters the narrative here, and he's not an actor in the narrative. He simply, these things happen to him. He doesn't speak or take actions or anything like that, but he is carried away. He is now, you notice in verse number 12, he's now living in Sodom, whereas earlier, when he had made his choice, he'd only moved toward Sodom. Now he's living in Sodom, and he is carried away along with the rest of them. So Lot and all of his goods were captured by these eastern kings, and they were taken away to the north. And then we come to verses 13 to 16. And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and a brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. And when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. And he divided himself against them, he and his servants by night, and smote them, and pursued them unto Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. And he brought back all the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot and his goods, and the women also, and the people. So really, everything that we have up to this point in the chapter is what you might call the setup, and Lot being carried away is obviously the prime incident, prime event where things begin to unfold. And so Abraham is informed that Lot has been carried away with those of Sodom. Now, here's where we want to slow down a little bit, and we want to start paying attention. As we've talked about a number of times, as we read through these accounts, the way that they're presented to us, the way that they're structured, the words and the images and the various phrases and things that are used, they all have their significance and indicate to us what it is that is being communicated. So this is the first place that Abram is called Abram the Hebrew, and that's there in verse number 13. Now, this is the first time that this occurs. That he was the Hebrew means he was an Abarite, or he was a descendant of Abar. And the word itself essentially means from beyond. Now, what is more important, though, as we read this account in its context, and Abraham being referred to as the Hebrew, is that this designation is now recognizing Abraham as a patriarch. He is now being recognized as a father of a nation, although that nation is yet to come. But we see him here being presented that way, and it actually begins this picture that we get of Abraham throughout this account. He's presented as Abraham the Hebrew. He's the patriarch. Well, we read then that Abraham was allied to Mamre, to Eshcol, and to Aner, these Amalekites. He had good relations with, had an alliance with. They probably, no doubt, worked to one another's benefit and maybe even come to one another's defense as needed and things such as that. And so we're told that along with this alliance, that Abraham took of his own household 318 trained servants to go and to assail those four eastern kings to recover his nephew Lot and all the things that had been carried away. Now, the word for trained servants, the halakim, this is the only place it appears in the Old Testament. And the word is related to being dedicated or to being instructed. And so it's emphasizing that it is a fighting force. So these are servants that have been trained apparently in skills of warfare and battle and defense. And we're told that there were 318 of them. Now, 318 is a very precise number. And oftentimes you'll find in the Bible that numbers are rounded to tens or hundreds, or it's very, very common for them. There are certain places where they will be given very precisely and other places where they're sort of more rounded. Well, this obviously doesn't appear to be a rounded number. This is 318 trained servants. So you encounter a number like that, it automatically stands out, and many people for many long centuries have pondered the significance of 318. Well, if you take the first number, that's 3. And 18 divided by 3 equals 6. And you know what else? If you multiply 6 by 53, you get 318. Well, that's all very interesting, but we're just sort of right back where we started and haven't really found any significance to that number, have we? We've just done a bunch of math. There was one commentator I read that observed that 318 is the sum of all the prime numbers between 7 and 7 squared. And if it's been a while since you've done math, 7 squared is 7 times 7, or the number 49. Now, he failed to point out what the significance of that was, but that is true of the number 318. Well, what does all that tell us? Well, maybe we just have to assume that the branch of mathematics that reveals the significance of 318 hasn't yet been discovered. That's the very similar to the conclusion that Clarence Larkin came to as concerning some of the numbers in Scripture he was trying to manipulate. All right, I don't believe that the point of the Bible telling us there were 318 servants is for us to do some sort of holy arithmetic or spiritual calculus to try to determine some hidden meaning. So what do we get from this? All right, so keep it in context. Read this in context of what we're presented in this chapter and the way that all the information is presented to us in this chapter. So again, the word for king, first time it appears in Genesis is here in Genesis 14. And in this chapter, it appears 27 times. It's obviously something that's stressed. So in this chapter, we're constantly reading about kings, we're reading about nations, we're reading about these great affairs of state. We have these coalitions between nations, we have other nations that are under tribute, we have rebellion that's taking place, we have international warfare that breaks out, all of these sort of things. In other words, as you read this, you get everything is on a large scale. And the effect of all of that is to make Abraham, the Hebrew, the foreigner from far away, seem very small and vulnerable and insignificant. In fact, his nephew Lot, which we would assume is much like Abraham, but yet Lot was just easily carried away. So what is going to be the result with Abraham? Abraham's smallness, you might say, is further highlighted by that fact. So, all of a sudden we read of Abraham the Hebrew, which makes him a patriarch. It makes him a person of some importance. And then we read that this wanderer in this foreign land with no children gathers 318 warrior servants of his own house. So suddenly, Abraham is not small. He's not vulnerable. He's not insignificant. How many of us, at a moment's notice, could gather 300 close friends and family to come to our aid in such an urgent matter? Well, I don't know about you, but I know I couldn't. So he's a warrior leader, and he's joined by his allies to pursue these great kings of the east who have just overrun all of the land of Canaan, and he prevails. Well, this is consistent with the rest of the chapter. In other words, Abraham here is pitted against this background of all of these great kings and great nations and great affairs, and yet Abraham is the one that emerges as superior to all of them, except for one, and we'll get to that in a moment. So Abraham pursues these kings all the way to Dan, it is. Now, Dan, obviously did not exist or was known as Dan in those days. Dan refers to the northern tribe of Israel. It was the northern territory of Israel that was probably about 140 miles from Hebron, where Abraham was. And Abraham pursues and he routs these eastern kings, and he recovers all that was taken away, and he brings it all back with the captive people. And there's no question as you read the account that Abraham is the leader of this little mission. Well, then we get to the second part of the chapter, verses 17 to 24, and this is where Abraham meets the priest king. Verse 17. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's dale. So the king of Sodom then comes out to meet Abraham. And now we're going to get our first really interchange and exchange. And this entire exchange between Abraham and the king of Sodom shows Abraham to be the superior. The king of Sodom is coming out to him to try to negotiate of sorts with him, but at the same time, it's obvious that he doesn't have the standing that Abraham does. Then we come to verses 18 to 20 before we get back to the king of Sodom. It says, "And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And he gave him tithes of all." So the king of Salem, we're told, also comes out to meet. Now Salem has not been mentioned to this point, but the king of Salem comes out to meet him just as the king of Sodom did upon his return. Now Salem refers to the area later that would be known as Jerusalem. And the name Salem itself means peace. And the name Melchizedek, it means king of righteousness. Not only is Melchizedek a king, but he's also a priest of the Most High God. Now this title, Most High God, El Elyon, Most High God, is a designation that here shows God as supreme over all. Again, think about what's in this chapter. These great kings, these great nations, and all these momentous events that are taking place, these great affairs of state and all of these things. And yet, God is supreme over all. And so the King of Peace comes out to meet Abraham with this designation. He's a priest of the Most High God. And then we're told that he blesses Abraham, and Abraham pays him a tithe of the spoil that he brought back, showing that Abraham was not superior to the priest king. Now, Melchizedek is a somewhat mysterious figure in Scripture, obviously. He only occurs, his name occurs after this in Psalm 110 and verse 4, and then a few times in the book of Hebrews. The only other mentions that we have of Melchizedek in the Bible. Well, the writer of Hebrews, though, and I'm going to read a portion of Hebrews chapter 7, even though the whole chapter really plays into this discussion. But the writer of Hebrews explains the significance of Melchizedek very plainly. Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 to 7. "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being by interpretation king of righteousness," that's what Melchizedek means, "and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace." Now, speaking of Melchizedek, the writer of Hebrews says, "Without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. And verily they that are of the sons of Levi, who receive the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose descent is not counted from them received tithes of Abraham and blessed him that had the promises. And without all contradiction, the less is blessed of the better. In other words, the writer of Hebrews says, Abraham paid tithes, so the less pays tithes to the greater. And Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and it's the greater that blesses the lesser. So Melchizedek is obviously a significant person. And yet, he's the only significant person in Genesis for whom we do not know his ancestors, nor do we know his descendants. So one of the difficulties when it comes to reading the book of Genesis itself is even a chapter like this, all these names and places that are so strange to us. Then we have these genealogies. We've already encountered several of those. And any person of any significance in the storyline of Genesis, we know their ancestors and we know their descendants, except for Melchizedek. Now, the writer of Hebrews is not here saying that Melchizedek was not a human man. Rather, he's saying that the way that he is introduced and presented to us in Genesis is unique. He's presented without, we don't read about his birth. We don't read about his life, the length of his life. Think of those genealogies. So-and-so begat so-and-so and lived this many number of years and he died. And so-and-so begat so-and-so and on those genealogies go. And we don't have any of that for Melchizedek. So I don't believe that he's telling us that he's Jesus Christ. Melchizedek, I don't believe, is Jesus Christ. He's a type of Christ, as the writer of Hebrews makes clear in the rest of chapter 7. Now, the importance of Melchizedek is clearly stated in Psalm 110 and verse 4, where the psalm says, "The Lord hath sworn and will not repent, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Now, the writer of Hebrews quotes this psalm, in fact, quotes it, I think, at least two times in Hebrews chapter number 7, as speaking of Jesus Christ. He is the one that's blessed forever, that's made a priest after the order of Melchizedek. So Jesus Christ, whose priesthood was not after the order of Aaron, it was not according to the law of Moses, it wasn't according to the old covenant, it was after the order of the priest-king Melchizedek. And so Genesis, by not giving us his parents, not giving us his birth, not giving us his children, not giving us his death, the order of his priesthood is shown to be everlasting. And that's what the writer of Hebrews is making a point of. Now, the writer of Hebrews also picks up on how that Genesis 14 frames Abraham as superior to all except for the priest king Melchizedek. The priest king blesses Abraham, and Abraham pays tithes. Again, Abraham is the lesser, the priest king is the greater, and Abraham acknowledges him as such. So, we get to verses 21 to 24, which give us the conclusion here and the rest of what happens with the king of Sodom. "And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, Give me the persons, and take the goods to thyself. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that's thine, lest thou shouldest say, I've made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, Mamre, let them take their portion." So the king of Sodom here tries to negotiate with Abraham. Of course, he's in the position of weakness and inferiority. And if you know anything about negotiation, you're never supposed to negotiate from a position of weakness. But that's where he's at. So in other words, the king of Sodom is at Abraham's mercy. The king of Sodom has absolutely no leverage whatsoever in this negotiation. He just tries to introduce this bargain, this deal, hoping that Abraham will take it. And however, when it turns around and you think about it, he ends up being blessed by Abraham because Abraham restores him all. He says, I'm not going to take a shoelace of anything that belongs to you, to Sodom. So he's blessed by Abraham, not in a way of Abraham giving him salvation, but he certainly is blessed by Abraham in very graphic form. So Abraham's faith is once again exhibited. It is displayed. He's not going to take any of this spoil to himself. He's not going to add any of this to his own personal wealth. The only thing that he does is that he is going to pay his servants and he is going to pay his allies for their service. He says, they've taken their portion and that is their due. But I am not going to take a thing from it. And he restores all to Sodom and to the king. Now again, as we read Genesis chapter number 14, we've got this chapter with these great battles. But again, there's very little description of the battles themselves. So the battles are obviously not really the point. So what is the point of Genesis chapter 14? Well, Abraham's faith is certainly tested once again. And as we said, that is quickly established as a thematic pattern. It's just going to continue. Abraham is going to continue to encounter tests to his faith. So his faith is certainly tested. But also what we see in Genesis chapter 14 are what we might call lesser fulfillments. In other words, sometimes God has given a promise, and this promise has a great final fulfillment. And ahead of the time of that great final fulfillment being reached, there are sort of lesser fulfillments that are indicators. They are pointers. So for instance, if you think about the captivity, when Judah was finally conquered by the Babylonians and they're carried away into captivity, and then you had the prophecy of the 70 years. And in 70 years, they're going to return. And many thought that this would mean this greater promise of restoration, where the kingdom was going to be restored to Israel. They're going to be restored to their land, and they're going to embrace and follow Yahweh's word. But obviously, that was not the case. So as you end the Old Testament, actually, you get that realization that this restoration hasn't happened. Israel is not faithful. There's only been a small remnant of the people that has actually returned to the land of Israel. They don't occupy it all. They're not an independent state. They're still under rule. So this greater fulfillment of this promise of restoration has not been fulfilled. But the very fact that they returned after 70 years, just like God said that they would, is a sign. It is an indicator that the greater fulfillment will be accomplished. It will happen. It's just not yet. Well, that's sort of the way that Genesis 14 functions as well. We get a fulfillment. It's not the full fulfillment of all God's promises to Abraham, but we do see indications of that fulfillment. So if you think back to Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 3, "Now the Lord had said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed." So in Genesis chapter 14, the enemies had run throughout this promised land. And in fact, they had covered it from north to south. They had covered the entirety of this land. And they were obviously threatening these promises to Abraham. In other words, there are other nations. There are other people that have staked their claims in this land. And certainly they're not going to just hand it over to Abraham's descendants. But as you read Genesis 14, what do you see? You see Abraham being shown as great. God said, I'm going to make you great. He's Abraham the Hebrew. He's shown here as the patriarch, as the leader of his household, of his clan, as it were. God fights against those who oppose Abraham. That's exactly what God promised. I will curse them that curse you. I'll bless them that bless you. He fights against those, and he blesses those who bless him. And so what we see in chapter 14 then, again, is just this small picture. These nations are blessed through Abraham. When he returns with the people and their goods and all of these things to their homes, they're blessed through Abraham. And then the encounter with Melchizedek shows Abraham as the servant of the Most High God. and dependent on him for the fulfillment of the promises. In other words, Abraham's mission here was not a conquest. Abraham did not set out with his trained servants and with his allies to conquer the land of Canaan and claim it and possess it for himself. That wasn't what he set out to do. He set out to recover what had been taken, and that's what he did. And then he returned, just the same as before he left. And again, he did not enrich himself even to a shoe from what he had recovered. So, no matter what we may think of ourselves, we really are small and insignificant on the world stage. We can look at many of the news stories and things and events happening around the world and all these global concerns and things taking place. And sometimes we might be saddened, we might be angry, whatever the case may be. But ultimately, we're very small and insignificant in terms of all of that. We're just a part of this of the statistics, you might say. And certainly that's the way that it would seem that Abraham was. But for everyone who believes, we have promises in God's promises to Abraham. That's whether we're Jews. If you're a Jew, you have particular promises. You're descendant from Abraham in that way. You have particular promises. You're a Gentile. You have particular promises from God in Abraham. So what I'm saying is that this chapter should help our faith to understand that God is supreme over all. And the nations are raging against him. And we may be just small, insignificant on any sort of national or global, international scale. But these nations are ultimately ruled over by God. They will be judged by him at the coming of his Son. And that there's no obstacle that can prevent those who trust in him from receiving their full inheritance. And again, we get just a small picture of that here in Genesis chapter number 14. And it really is a chapter that ought to encourage and help to strengthen us as well.